If Didier Deschamps were to leave and Zinedine Zidane were available and he was not picked by the French Federation, the headquarters of the French Federation would have to look at what happened at the Bastille.
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
All right, it's 7:30 this Wednesday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM, and it is a very special extended cast of characters. Owen's here. Owen, good morning to you.
How are you, Ger?
Kenny's here as well. Kenny, how are you?
Morning, lads.
Oh, look, they put you in the big box, Kenny. Look, look, you're on the big box. You're the main man.
Hey.
Congratulations. You've made it now.
I look a little on there in the corner. Look, look.
Kenny gave me strict instructions this morning to not be looking down the camera, to look into his eyes, deep down into his soul. So no, apologies to everybody at home this morning. No, this is where I'm looking.
You think he's being rude to you, but actually he's being rude to the people at home who are taking their time to watch
it. Yeah, but as you know, Jer, it's all about me.
Well, it turns out that's true.
It is.
End of. Yeah, no, it's very, I do find it a bit off. It is a bit off-putting, isn't it? Trying to engage with somebody and they're looking in the opposite direction.
But I'm not looking in the opposite direction. I'm actually looking straight into your soul, Kenny. That's what I'm doing. I'm looking straight into your soul and the souls of all the people who are watching us at home.
Anyway, just saying.
Do you never watch TV and you're like, and they're not looking at you ever, and you're like,
now people on the are looking down the TV at you, and you're looking at the TV,
and you feel like they're talking to you.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the people in the room. That's different for the viewer at home, isn't it? If you're actually with it in the confines of the studio, and there's no kind of eye contact being made, that's
We obviously do a little bit, you know. It's a little dark from
token,
here.
Isn't it?
Token. It's not. I'm trying to keep. I'm juggling many balls, Kenny. That's what's happening.
Owen's different. Owen's different to you. You're kind of like, you're ruthless, Jer, aren't you? You're ruthless.
I knew there was something missing whenever I turn on RT and Kenny's in studios. Like, just the analysis is excellent, but I'm just missing something. Now I know. It's just that little look, the Butch Harmon look down the camera. If you do that, I'll be a loyal viewer.
Just saying.
I think Nathan Murphy is with us. Nathan, good morning to you.
I'm just glad to see that Kenny is still alive. We were on commentary in the North London Derby on Sunday, cracking game. Finished the post-show wrap about 30 seconds after the game. Walked out to say, good job, Kenny. No sign of Kenny. Gone. In a flash. Never has a man moved as quickly in his life.
I don't know why I bothered, to be honest with you.
I was going to say you didn't hear all that, but you did hear it. I'm glad, because the earphones were...
torn down.
Yeah. I don't know why you bothered.
I think Nathan's referencing the golf, which obviously was the reason why I was hightailing out of studio.
Last week you were in studio, Kenny, and you told us that... at one stage in Medina you were happy enough that it was over because you're like, oh, I can relax now and enjoy this. You were able to relax and enjoy the golf pretty much from Saturday morning. Late Friday afternoon, it was like, well, this is going one way and there ain't no way back.
Take it back. Didn't enjoy it.
No. That
was horrible. Yeah, Sunday evening. Nathan mentioned there. I left the studio on a little bit of a high, I'd have to say, Nathan. It was a great game. The Arsenal game, Spurs. Flew up to a pal's house to watch the singles. Jumped in, TV on, had a quick look up at the screen. Oof. Nah, it's all over, wasn't it? Hoping to see that splash, more than a splash of blue on the screen, but there was nothing. Not even a hint of a comeback, was that? No. I hope those opening three or four games, you hope beyond hope, don't you? You know, you win those first three kind of four games and maybe baby, but no, it was just never going to happen, was it? And you're right, it was, I didn't enjoy it. It was horrible, actually, for a load of different reasons. It was just the fact that point it was over. Oh, it was a load of different stuff. I don't really want to talk about it, to be honest.
That bad?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of stuff, a bit of the behaviour. I mean, the fans and all that, Nathan. I mean, there's always a bit of that over there, the American... support, but that was great in a little bit. Some of the shouts from the side, but he sucked that up. But I actually thought some of the behaviour of the American players as the day went on was like, talk about it, like classless. I mean, glugging down tins of beer on the side of the fairway as they're, you know, as the game is, the matches are kind of still in progress, and you know, having the banter with the fans.
For the sake of balance, a friend of mine was there and he was you're supporting Europe, dressed like the Europeans should be, and having the crack. And he said that it was Casey and whoever was playing in that match, that they were riling the crowd, And then the two Americans came and riled the crowd, and the beers got thrown, and they drank them, and it was a joke. And Casey and him were having the crack with them. So the Europeans, like, what we saw was this small vision of it, but the people who were actually there were like, it was in.
On the last day, I know you. I think that was the one the day before. I referenced the day before. I think it was like Justin Thomas sat out the afternoon, didn't they, Nathan? They were having that little bit of repertoire, whatever, on the first day, and all the beer. I didn't like it anyway. Take your point, Casey, my there, whatever. But on the last day, when those singles were finishing, and those players were finished, I think Justin Thomas was one of them again, and they're walking down the fairway, and obviously keeping in contact with the other matches on the course. There was like, you know, they were holding the beers in their hand. Then the crowd would go, "Way!" And then the beers would be down them one away, fisting. I just thought it was like.
Is that not the magic of the Ryder Cup? Do you not need that once every couple of years?
No.
The difference and the crowd get involved.
I don't want the crowd involved, Nathan, and all that type of thing. That kind of crowd, I just didn't like it. I love the celebrations and you're entitled to, but generally that's when it's over. You know, hands have been shaken. The winning team goes back to the clubhouse. We've seen all those scenes before, champagne on the clubhouse and that type of thing. And that's fantastic. And that you're entitled to do that. But this was a little bit different for me. Maybe it was the fact, obviously, we'd lost and it was all a bit miserable anyway. You know what I mean? But no, I didn't like it.
But it raises the question of, once the Ryder Cup is won, should they just stop playing?
No, yeah. Just bring everybody in off the course. You want to see the margin of victory.
You had another couple of hours there where actually, I think that's why they just started drinking, because they knew they had a couple of hours before it was all going to be over, because it was such a convincing win.
It's a fair argument, to be honest with you, because it is a proper damn squib after that. I wouldn't say it's gone through the motions to a certain extent, because obviously players want to win, don't they? But it's not the same, is it? I mean, the focus isn't there. Players know it's over. Maybe you should just sound the horn, like I said, as that with.
Well, I'm going to sound the horn in this introduction. So let's tell you what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock on the morning. We're going to talk about the Champions League. We're going to speak rugby essentially from 8 until 9. We're talking about the women's team from 8:15. We're talking about the men's game from 8:30. After that, from 9:05, Graham Hunter's going to join us, and we'll replay a segment of Keith Andrews' interview with Joe yesterday at 7:37, though. A reminder that OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Could Lionel Messi do it on a wet Tuesday night? They were all the jokes beforehand. And it was like, no, he's kind of washed up, isn't he? But no is the answer, Kenny. Lionel Messi, not washed up. Able to produce a moment that was a replica of all the moments he's produced in his career since he was a 17-year-old. The longevity is sensational. The fact that he's doing it against Man City at this stage of his career is sensational. We are blessed to be amongst Lionel Messi.
Oh, you've gone for it there, Ger. You've gone for it. First of all, I didn't see the whole of the game last night. I was watching the Liverpool game, so it was a good goal. I heard it described by a couple of people as, this is amongst the best goals. He's, blah, blah, blah. But
we've seen the goal a million times. We've literally seen that goal a million times from Leo Messi, and his ability to still do. When somebody beats you doing stuff that you know they're going to do, that's either you're very stupid.
You actually see what he did, though. He actually didn't do an awful lot, funny enough, when he picked up the ball. You're talking about some of the great Messi goals you're talking about, like slalom around three or four players, check, through the legs, getting people off balance, over needle stuff, and then back in there. Basically, just there, he just ran in a straight line, just lended it to Mbappe, you know, got it back, and it was a brilliant finish, like, you know what I mean? I wouldn't have it up there to be top 40 Messi goals, to be honest with you.
What I'm saying is he's done it.
I'm just saying, taking it down a peg or two, like you're giving it the big. So it was a fine goal. I didn't see his overall performance. I don't know, he might have kicked the ball for the rest of the game. I don't know. So in terms of the impact going forward he's going to have there, let's wait and see. But I will concede it was a tidy finish.
from the man who literally never scored a goal.
That's cheap, isn't it? Is that going to be Nathan's comeback every single? I'm not allowed to criticise any striker. That's just going to be the comeback, isn't it?
No, the default
comeback.
In fairness, my comeback would have been,
I wouldn't say that. I would have never
Kenny,
come back.
Kenny
to
at least
that.
Has I'm seen all of the great goals scored. He was on the field for Beckham. He was on the field for Yeboah. He was on the field for the Canio. So he knows a world class finish when he sees one as it flies over his head.
Can I just add, what is the difficulty level? And it's probably under five of what Kylian Mbappe does here, because all night Kylian Mbappe is trying to, I felt kind of pointedly, create opportunities for his teammates. There was a couple of opportunities in the first half where you're like, go yourself. and he just squares the ball, and it's like there was no need for him to do this whatsoever. And on this occasion, he was the perfect foil for Messi to score the most Messi goal. Is that harder than it looks, Kenny, or is it simple? When you're operating at that level, it is literally just a 1-2 and get the hell out of his way and let Messi do his thing.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't think it was a decent little layoff from Mbappe. Obviously, he showed up, but yeah, it was. You could see it almost coming. You know, Messi heading towards him, just laying it off. There wasn't much Mbappe could do, kind of back to goal. So it was a decent enough touch from him. So yeah, it was just, I couldn't get overly excited. It'd be interesting just to see how that front three, how they interlink going forward. I think there's still,
let me ask you about the defenders. Why could the defenders not stop Leo Messi when you've seen Messi pick the ball up in the right wing spot and you know that he's going to do his arc and run and he's probably going to play 1-2 when he's going to have a shot? Why could the
It was kind of on transition, wasn't it? So Man City work was as if they're in a kind of compact defensive shape. When he ran inside, he was running into traffic. They're obviously committed to going forward. They lost possession, wasn't it? And the ball popped out, so before City can regain,
they had a pretty stupid long-range shot. Actually.
You look to your holding midfielder there. Anytime an opposition player receives the ball in that area and drives in the inside, you're looking to your central field to come across and bang him. Like, that wasn't the case. Obviously, they're stretched a little bit up the pitch. And Messi being Messi, of course, he gets his head out before, you know, runs into those kind of spaces. I think Laporte generally does okay, to be honest, with you, following him on the inside. But what he does wrong, it's only a split second thing. When Messi lends the ball into Mbappe, if you notice, he just kind of decelerates for a split second. I.e., he's popped the ball off, or suddenly your mindset's thinking, oh, now he's not a danger. Maybe the danger's somewhere else. So by the time he realises, oh, there's a chance he's going to get this back and assess the situation, it's just too late. It's just too late for him to react and get in contact with Messi. And of course, Messi has a touch there. Laporte probably gets back and makes a tackle. But of course, he's clever enough just to realise that. Yeah.
The genius is the finish as well, because any other player, you expect them to go maybe low, bottom, left-hand corner.
Don't try and climb his top corner either, Nathan. Saw a few people do that.
Ederson is thinking, I'm going to dive to my right here. And next thing, he just flicks it straight into not quite the top corner, but as close as he could possibly get it to the top corner.
Yeah. No, he's brilliant.
I watched the game last night, Kenny, and like, Messi was definitely far more involved in, say, the last Champions League game. I know Owen saw him last week and can talk about how he was getting on in the league matches. But the big issue for Paris Saint-Germain again seemed to be the lack of connection between the midfield and the three forward players. And you look at the midfield that Paris Saint-Germain have, like, they didn't start Wijnaldum last night, but Ander Herrera, Idrissa Gueye, Marco Verratti. It's not the worst midfield in Europe.
Verratti's brilliant.
Verratti's
brilliant, but he's only back from injury and he didn't last the full 90 minutes last night. Like,
if you have a midfield of Verratti...
That's a stretch.
Verratti, Wijnaldum and Idrissa Gueye, is that not a top quality midfield that can properly connect a defence in an attacking three?
I would have thought so. Kenny, you disagree on Verratti anyway?
Well, not the three that are on the table last. No, I like Verratti. I wouldn't say he's a top-class midfield player. I wouldn't say he's the elite in terms of central midfield players. And I think that is an issue. Kind of said it, I think it was the previous Champions League game, and a lot of talk about the front three, but that midfield three. I know Ronaldo didn't play last night, but when you're talking about, I mean, Andres Herrera, anytime you've got Andres Herrera in your centre midfield, you know, you've got to be asking questions, let's be honest. I mean, Idrissa Gueye is a competitive, kind of high energy, you know, decent all round action midfield player. Paredes is there as well. He's technically a decent player, not the greatest athlete in my opinion. So
I think you're underrating Verratti. I think Verratti could be one of the great sixes in world football.
Could be, or what? I think he is.
I'm saying he definitely. Give me five better sixes than Verratti in world football at the moment.
Yeah, well,
or three.
Do you want to commit the rest of the show to this?
Well, I think he's a very good player.
Verratti.
I'd rather have him than Declan Rice at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment, I think Declan Rice will be the better player in a couple of years' time. I think he's a better player out there than Declan Rice. I think they're a little bit short in centre midfield. If you're talking about PSG for the Champions League, you can pick apart most teams in certain respects. So I think that central midfield area dynamic, and I'm not quite seeing at the moment from PSG. Defensively, I've no problem with them there. I think they're good enough. Goalkeeper, obviously. And just the front three, certain aspects of the front three, just in terms of, you know, how they're going to defend collectively as a team, you know, how much that front three is going to commit. to what Pochettino wants from them. Probably one of the reasons why Idrissa De Gea and Herrera are actually in the team, to be fair, to give Pochettino a bit of credit. It's probably for that reason, because of the qualities of the front three out possession. He doesn't want to place too many demands on them. So to counteract that, he feels as if he needs to get at least kind of two runners of sorts in that central midfield. That'd be probably Idrissa De Gea and Herrera. So maybe that's like the little kind of counterbalance he feels he needs in those midfield areas to get that front three on the pitch.
Yeah, it's a lot of energy that they have.
Can Poch increase the work rate and maybe the defensive capabilities of that front three, Kenny? Because it seems to me that certainly over the last season and a half, Neymar has improved in that department. Now, in fairness, he couldn't have got much worse. He was coming from a pretty low base. But it looks like Neymar, in comparison to Mbappe anyway, is more reliable when you're out of possession at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There were signs of that kind of last season, particularly the Champions League. There was a lot of comment. I think you could see it actually, yeah. Maybe in terms of putting more of a shift in for the team. But you always feel as it's an effort, isn't it? With Neymar, you don't really feel as if potentially he's going to sustain that. And to a certain extent, but Mbappe, I think Mbappe, it's there, but just don't feel as if with these players, it's just they're switched onto it. Do you know what I mean? Constantly, I don't think it's a case of maybe Mbappe, he doesn't want to do it. It's just a case of actually understanding your role at times out of possession. There's a bit of intelligence involved in that as well. As much as there is when he receives the ball and he beats two or three players and, oh, that's fantastic. Out of possession, like, you do need a certain kind of mindset, not just a mentality, but an understanding what's required of you. And some players just not as good at it as others. So yeah, I think that would be interesting how Pochettino kind of manages that going forward, and even like individually how your man manages those players, gets in their head and just draws that little bit more out of the front three in terms of the team ethic and kind of work rate and all those things.
Sorry, we should just say, by the way, that Pep Guardiola was on the record about Marco Verratti last night. He said, "Let me say, I'm in love with Marco Verratti. He is an exceptional player. He is small, but you can always count on him. I'm happy he's back from injury." So Pep loves him, Kenny.
Tapping up.
Yeah.
Me and Pep.
The great football minds have united.
I'm in love. He is an exceptional player because when he is under pressure, he is calm. He has an extra touch to create extra passes behind our midfield. Now we are going to eat good, drink a glass of wine and recover. All right, Pep, calm down a little bit on the Marco Verratti love, I would suggest. Playing in the blue of City next season.
Too happy, a little bit too happy for me. Opposition manager's gone there and got turned over. A little bit too much love coming from him there.
He's not a great loser, Pep, is he? He doesn't really know how to deal with it very well.
Exactly,
which is,
yeah,
probably one of the best things about him. We were talking about what the range of outcomes for Paris Saint-Germain were. It could have gone off the tracks. It could go absolutely amazingly well. They could be a middle of the road team. It's hard to know because it's very early on. But a big win like this against a Man City team who are full of confidence after their performance at the weekend, that's the type of thing that smooths over the cracks, that all of a sudden, I don't know if you noticed, any time Neymar took a shot, Mbappe was in pretty good position. And he would always kind of, there was always like a over gesticulation. And then when Messi scores, the first person over to celebrate with him is Neymar, and he's hugging Neymar, but he's looking straight over, pointing to Kylian Mbappe, pointing to Mbappe, and Mbappe's very slow to get over, and Messi keeps pointing at him, and still Mbappe's not there, and he keeps pointing at him, and eventually Mbappe makes it. And then there's a photograph in the changing room of the three of them afterwards, all tops off, embracing. This is the, you know, oh, we're made.
Cans of beer with a glugging down there, kind of Ryder Cup style.
Champagne in Paris, obviously.
What's your point at the end?
My
of
point
this,
is they need results like this to get the gel.
Yeah,
to make
I think it helps.
Exactly. It's hugely important. Like, against City, that's a big win.
Yeah, but I don't think you were looking at that PSG team and thinking of, you know, they're a little bit. I think that PSG team is good enough. We're talking Champions League here, aren't we? Forget about, obviously, the domestic league, but they've been around it for the past couple of years. Champions League, you know what I mean?
But the politics are off the charts.
The politics are off the chart, but fundamentally, when you look at the squad, It's up there.
Yeah,
it's as good as anything. I'm talking about the midfield potentially, the balance there, not quite. That's fair enough. Like I say, you know, maybe small detail to a certain extent. If you ask me, maybe why possibly they won't win it, but it's a knockout competition, Champions League, and on any given day, we know that this team is good enough. And Messi finds a little bit of kind of match fitness, not so much form, but you know, that kind of mojo comes between the front three and they get it right behind them. Like I said, defensive, I quite like the look of them the last season. Like Marquinhos, Kimbemba there at centre half, potentially strong central defensive partnership, the keeper coming in as well.
He was excellent last night.
Yeah, fullback. So there's a lot of good there, don't get me wrong. Like I said, you can pick any team apart, but they are in good shape and potentially could get a little bit better, I'd suggest, as the season goes on.
All right, Liverpool absolutely hammered Porto last night, their traditional winning margin in Porto. They've won 5-0 and 4-0, I think, they're the last two. Am I no goals for Porto?
No goals, I think. Yeah. Right.
And then 5-1 last night as well. So you were watching this, Liverpool, fairly sensational start.
The first half, right? Gotta be honest with you. My ma switched over, silent witness. It was over, the game was over. I couldn't stamp my feet. Liverpool 2-0 up. Yeah, second part from the night before, so yeah. Now they played well. I was impressed, actually. Like, almost played within themselves, controlled the game. Talking about PSG, Nathan, in terms of maybe the balance in the team, but I just thought Liverpool was actually the opposite, kind of midfield and the front three perfectly in tandem. Looked impressive in possession, looked quite impressive out of possession. Was pleased to see Jones get a start in midfield off the back of his performance at the weekend. Probably said it before, like, gone over all ground, but for me, like, he's the future in central midfield. I'd love to see him get a run of games. Been saying that for about a year now. I think Klopp's got to commit to him. I think he's the answer.
Is he the near future, Kenny? Because obviously they're playing Manchester City on Sunday. Is Curtis Jones, has he the ability to go into a game like that against a City midfield with all their quality and get enough possession to make an impact?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I think he is. I've been looking for him there. Even last year, I was looking at him thinking I think he is now ready, because when he first came into the team, Nathan, very good technical player. He could impact the game the last tours. A couple of spectacular goals when he first came into Liverpool's team, wasn't I? Remember one against Everton, etc., etc. So you see the kind of quality there. I looked at him and thought, well, defensively, how good is he? Do you have to carry him out of possession of the ball? And you thought, well, that's an area of the game he needs to improve. Still quite young, still developing physically, all those type of things. But for me, since then, he's kind of grown. Not that I've seen a huge amount of him. He's used him sparingly, Klopp, isn't he? But I got to a stage last season, he came in for a couple of games early on, Nathan, and I was looking at him thinking, physically now he looks stronger. The defensive side of the game has improved. You know, he's tracking people. He understands his role now defensively. You don't have to carry him. And that's important in this Liverpool team, because like we said, Mike spoke after the AC Milan game, the type of football which they play, that heavy metal, that kind of template which has been successful for Liverpool, they need those type of, in the central midfield, you need those players, high energy. You can't carry anybody in there in possession and out of possession. And he, for me, last year, I looked at him and thought, he's ready now. I was waiting for Klopp to give him, you know, say, off you go, foot 6, 7, 8, 9 games and cement that place. And it never happened. He never kind of trusted him for whatever reason. Thiago obviously came in, played his filler games. And for me, actually blocked his pathway a little bit, Curtis Jones. And now we've seen him for the last couple of games. I mean, again, I'm seeing more of what I saw last season. I saw once in the first half last night, Porto kind of broke out, Liverpool on the attack. They kind of broke out down the side. He stepped across from central midfield. There was a lad breaking down the side. Just smashed him physically, put his arm across him, just eased him off the ball and won back possession for Liverpool. Didn't see him much in isolation, but I just thought to myself, another indicator that this lad's ready. Because in possession, Nathan, you can't pick him apart. He's getting on the ball, he's using it well, he's punched, he's breaking the lines with his passing, he's linking up well, he travels with the ball, Nathan, he's a dribbler, he travels with the ball, he goes past people. I know he didn't go past anybody for the first goal, but he dropped the shot, he came inside, he got this shot on target. And now out of possession, I'm seeing a player who you can trust out of possession, understands his role, you know, tracking people, kind of making tackles, a good athlete, he's mobile. So for me now, he's the answer. He's the answer in that central midfield. If you're going to go with three in there, it's going to be Fabinho and Henderson. For me at the moment, he's the third one. You could argue maybe Keita, off his performance against AC Milan, has attributes to playing there as well. But these are the two players for me you've got to dovetail between in that Liverpool midfield three, particularly the game against Manchester City coming up the weekend. So, yeah, he was the one I was really impressed with, but it was a really impressive first half performance in Liverpool.
How big a challenge do you think it'll be for him if he gets into a situation where he needs to play in a midfield where either one of Fabinho or Henderson aren't always available?
Yeah, no problem. I just think he's good enough, regardless of what's happened around him. I just think he's got the game now. I'm looking at him to he can survive in that kind of company now. Just a little bit. I wouldn't say arrogance, but he exudes a bit of confidence now, doesn't he, on the pitch? Jones always has done. I think he's had that little bit to his personality. Heard somebody say, well, maybe that's an issue with him, Klopp. He's a little bit too confident in himself, carries himself a little bit too much confidence. Maybe so. I'm not around the football club. Maybe Klopp had to keep a little bit of that in check early in his career. You know what I mean? Maybe he feels a little bit more mature now. But he certainly gave that type of performance last night. Just saw bits of the game against Brentford. Obviously got the goal against Brentford at the weekend. Spoke to a few people, said he played well. So I think he's the answer. Like, you know, I don't see where you can pull him apart. We can have a conversation about other players. We've spoken about, I know Thiago's getting a bit boring out before, but he's got some outstanding attributes, Thiago, but there's certain aspects to his game which he can't pull apart. And there's no getting away from in terms of his lack of mobility and his, you know, his lack of defensive qualities. Where Jones, for me, has improved that side of his game. And with the attacking attributes which he has, what we've spoken about, for me, he's developing into a really, really all-rounded central midfield player. Probably more so than any other Liverpool player, actually, in the team. They all have their own attributes. Fabinho, kind of that defensive linchpin, etc., etc., and Henderson. But this lad, for me, his game is actually more polished than them all, potentially.
He's an eight, is he? Is that his position? Like, or is he a six?
I think potentially you could see him in the two. He'll play as an eight in the three at the moment. One of those advanced, no problem at all. But I think potentially you could see him in a two. If that defensive side of his game improves, as it has been, and that's rock solid, you could see him playing in an orthodox two. And that's interesting because I think the discussion for me going forward, and we couldn't have it last season because it all went off Liverpool last year in terms of injuries, etc. Everybody's fit now, everybody's looking strong. The game against Manchester City is coming up. The argument is going to become even more so with Firmino scoring two goals last night. Can you squeeze this from forward into the starting lineup? Salah, Mane, Firmino, and Jota. We saw it last year, Nathan, even that Manchester City game, if memory serves me correctly, which doesn't often, but I think Klopp started with the front four. So if the argument starts and Klopp thinks I'm tempted to actually get that front four on the pitch, now you can only play with a midfield two. You can only play with those two number sixes that Jair's talking about. Now who your six is going to be, that for me is more interesting. You know, is it going to be, you know, Henderson and Fabinho, a real kind of defensive axis there, or are you going to be a little bit braver, choose one of those two that I've spoken about and throw in the Curtis Jones, who's that more of a box-to-box and contribute in different areas of the pitch? So that for me is more of an interesting discussion going forward for Liverpool this season.
Has that ever worked for Liverpool so far? Like, has there been a game off the top of your head where they've gone with the four lads up front and you've thought to yourself, right, this is actually something they can work
wasn't
with?
Wasn't it City last year they went to the Etihad, wasn't it, off the back of the European game?
They lost. Oh, that was the draw last year. The one all draw, the first of the matches.
Yeah, I can't remember. I know he went with the four and everybody was like, oof, what's going on here? I think Firmino...
Do you get the best out of Salah if you're playing with a four? Does Salah not end up stuck out in the wing a little bit more?
No, I don't think so, no. There shouldn't be any... Shouldn't be any reason necessarily why you shouldn't have the same effect. And he can play anywhere. Salah can play center. You can throw him. But there's an argument for when you play with the three, Nathan, and you don't play with the number 10 as Liverpool do at the moment. You play with the three centre midfield, 6-2-8, and you play with the front three. Now, when Liverpool are at their best, say it's Firmino more so than Jota, when that number 10 drops in and drops off the front into deep areas and drags one of those opposition centre-halves up the pitch, opens up space, that was creating space for Mane and Salah to make those diagonal runs in behind, and they kind of had quite a lot of success with that. When you play with the front four, your central striker generally has to stay a little bit higher up the pitch because you're actually playing with a 10 in behind. So that forces your central striker a bit higher up the pitch. So that pens the opposition centre-halves in. So that makes it a little bit harder for those wide men to come inside and time those runs. You're not driving into space now. You're driving into two opposition centre-halves. So not so easy to thread those balls into the wingers coming on the inside. So that's the only small thing I'd say. But such is the quality that Liverpool for Salah has coming on the inside, playing little combinations in the individual quality. I don't think it'd be a big issue. And there's an extra player up there. You've got an extra player up there, Firmino, to work those kind of little combinations high up the pitch. So I'm quite interested in seeing it. You know, rather than picking three out of four, a lot of the talk will be who drops out. Is it Firmino? Is it Jota? Who's going to make way? Is it going to be Mane? Well, the conversation might become, well, let's play the four of them and let's have a conversation about that midfield two now, that midfield axis in central midfield.
He played Wijnaldum and Henderson there last season against City, and those four did play. Now, whatever lineup this is, has it as a 4-2-3-1 with Mane, Firmino, and Jota behind Salah, as the way that the team lined out. I don't know if he would do that now, maybe six Salah on the right and Jota through the middle, or I don't know.
It can easily be done, but it changes the dynamic. Liverpool's template, the success they've had, have always been off that 4-3-3, those three high energy box to box central midfield players. That's how they played. That's how they're set up to play. And it does change the dynamic slightly when you sacrifice one of them and go with the front four. People are like, well, it makes you stronger from an attacking point of view. Surely you got an extra world class attacker on the bench. Yeah, does it leave you a little bit more open defensively? Well, that's the argument, I suppose. That's the interesting conversation.
Now, he did that last year when he didn't have his first choice centre back partnership. It was Joe Gomez and Matip playing centre back last year. So it'll be interesting to see if he goes with it this year with Virgil.
Does it make it more likely, the fact that Alexander-Arnold is injured and is going to miss the game, that you can three midfielders, you know you've got somebody to cover for Alexander-Arnold when he's bombing forward down the right-hand side. You've got to assume he'll play Milner at right-back again.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Joe Gomez has had against City.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a good point, because when you play with the three narrow in midfield, it's easier for one of those midfielders to get out quickly. It's usually Jordan Henderson who plays in that right-sided number eight when Liverpool play with a three. And he'd be a little bit closer contact with James Milner on that side and get across easier and kind of double up with him in those situations. When you play with a midfield two that we're talking about, the distance is a little bit greater for that central midfield to get out in contact with the fullback on that side of the pitch. So I think you're right. If Klopp's thinking Milner's going to play there, I want to give him a little bit more protection against Grealish. I think you're right, Nathan. Then you stick to the three in there. You play Henderson kind of right side of a three, as he generally does, and you make him aware of the fact that out of possession, he's got to get back in contact and double up with James Milner every single time.
Okay, so that Liverpool in very good situation as it stands in the Champions League after a 5-1 win at Porto last night. The other game in that group, AC Milan were 1-0 up and a man down at half-time. Atletico came back to win 2-1 with a goal in the 97th minute, I think, from the penalty spot from Luis Suarez. So that's a big win for Atletico in that group. We've already told you Paris Saint-Germain beat Man City 2-0. Club Brugge went to Leipzig and won 2-1. So that's Brugge after a draw with Paris Saint-Germain the first day and a win at Leipzig. That's suddenly they're a real-life prospect in that group. Ajax beat Besiktas 2-0. Dortmund beat Lisbon 1-0. Shakhtar and Inter drew 0-0. And Real Madrid equalised after 69 minutes. Flick on the live score commentary and they're like, oh, half an hour left for Real Madrid to win this game against FC Sheriff. Your boys, Owen.
Our boys.
Yeah, and Sheriff scored a late winner in the Santiago Bernabeu.
Unbelievable goal for anybody who hasn't seen this. An absolute screamer. And it's quite a boring statistic, but I reckon this is the first win in the Champions League for a team that associate themselves with the hammer and sickle of the Soviet Union since Dynamo Kiev in 1991. So that's what I think, unless there was some sort of other Soviet outpost that competed in the Champions League and won a game. I'm not so sure. There is a phenomenal Twitter thread for anybody who wants to read up on them by a guy called Slava Malamud, who compared the country to those Japanese soldiers who kept on fighting into the 1970s because they thought World War II was still on. That's how he compares the people of Transnistria who associate themselves with this football club. A fascinating geopolitical story. Not a romantic one for anybody who wants to use that phrase, but an underdog story all the same. Just five Moldovans in the squad.
They don't consider themselves Moldovan, isn't that the whole point?
Correct, yeah. That's the thing. An interesting kind of place for the UN to wade into because they don't exactly recognise them.
Sebastian Thiel, who scored the goal, Luxembourg international, didn't get off the bench in the win against the Republic of Ireland.
Oh, there was another Thiel, wasn't there, on the pitch?
There's three Thiels.
Three Thiels, yes.
Three of them. The youngest brother is the most highly rated of them, the one who caused all the problems. Saw him go maybe to one of the bigger clubs. Seems to have sort of gone off to Ukraine, I think, to play his football. The Thiel, who was impressive. But again, you look at that Luxembourg side, they've got a couple of players playing Champions League football this season. We don't.
This is a disaster for Real Madrid. Or will they be okay? Is this going to squeak out of the group?
I don't think it matters whether they squeak out of the group or not. Really, they're short, aren't they? They're kind of well short in terms of Champions League for me. But both Spanish clubs, really, aren't they?
But of the big ones, anyway. Like if you go through their table at the moment, like you'd expect Atletico Madrid to be maybe the most likely of the Spanish clubs to do something in the competition this year. Now, in fairness, Real Madrid do have a win on the board, and they might yet get out of that group. I mean, it is a freak result. Sheriff, two wins from two, by the way, and sitting top of that group. And then, obviously, you're talking about Barcelona as well, who are sitting bottom of their group, behind Benfica, behind Dynamo Kiev, with Bayern Munich on top of Group E at the moment. That's after one game, obviously, their second game tonight in that one. But, yeah, Atletico probably the biggest shot of the three you suspect.
Yeah, I throw Villarreal in there, to be honest with you. Yeah, I was really impressed in the last season, obviously, in terms of winning the Europa. And I just like the way they're set up. They're really well set up, well drilled. Technique's not too many standout players, but really good, really well set up, kind of in and out of possession. So I think they're the type of team who could kind of navigate their way through the group stages. I know it's not easy in Manchester United's group, it's not a given, but I think United have it all to do against them tomorrow evening. I wouldn't want to be playing these off the back of, you know, United coming to the game lack a bit of confidence, and you want to give it a game, like, really, in terms of getting yourself back on track. This isn't it. These are a really clever outfit, got some good operators.
You got Unai Emery on the record this week saying he hopes Solskjaer gets a long-term contract. That seems to be like
another one.
A bit of a meme.
Just after he signed his other long-term contract, he just signed him 3 months ago, didn't he, Solskjaer?
Yeah.
Did I get that right today? I thought he signed a
4-5
year deal.
Well, I think he said he hopes United stick with Solskjaer, which, whenever you see that written anywhere, it's usually like a Liverpool fan or something like that saying, "I hope it's Solskjaer." So I'm not sure if Emery is trolling Manchester United or not. But I don't know. Like, I mean, where are you on Solskjaer, Kenny? I'm sure this has been brought up with you in the not too distant past.
I'm not too sure. In terms of what?
In terms of the current job that he's doing.
Stick or twist?
What, today?
Well, yeah. How much longer does he have before you decide, right, look, you gave it your best shot. Thanks very much. You're a club legend. You did your best, but it ain't good enough.
Yeah, I think that's fair, to be honest with you. I think we're getting close to that. To that point, you look at the makeup of the squad, the purchases that have been made. We could have, you know, discussion about in terms of did they have to reinforce and in certain areas, would you spend the money in different areas? But where they are at the moment, the players that they have, is a pretty strong squad. So as a manager, you've got to get the best out of it. You've got to manage the dressing room, manage the individual players, etc., etc. But a big part of the game, regardless of the personnel, is just your kind of tactical acumen, really, as a manager. You know, how you set up your bodies. Do you get the balance right in terms of the team that you put on the pitch? And also big decisions when they come during the course of the season. And he's had a couple of them already, particularly in the game against Young Boys not too long ago with the sending off. He had some big decisions there to make. I'm not too sure he got them right. And I just don't feel as if that's maybe one of his strengths, you know, when big decisions arrive during the game, maybe latter stage of the second half. You got to change things up, and opposition managers does something, and you've got to do things quick. You've got to assess it quickly and make the right decision. I doubt him a little bit, you know. But I know body language isn't everything, but sometimes you never get a sense if he's got a clear picture in terms of what he needs to do. A lot of talk and a lot of discussion going on the sideline with his cohorts around him in terms of what it needs to be done. So I think some managers are very clear and are very good at it. I think Tuchel, to be fair, has really impressed me in that respect since he's come in. You know, never kind of hesitates, you know, if changes need to be made, whether it's the actual setup of the team prior to the game or even during the course of the game, tactical changes have to be made. They're made and you can see it. They're kind of clear, you know, they're unambiguous in terms of what he's doing. And I'm always thinking, yeah, that's good, that's shrewd, I can see what he's done there. You know, whereas Solskjaer, I think, I'm not too sure about, and it's not everything, but I think it's an important cog in the wheel in terms of having that ability to assess things coolly as the game's going on and make those kind of judgment calls and make those substitutions and get those decisions right. So I would question that. I would question his ability to a certain extent in that respect, and that could be a problem.
Can you learn that on the job, or can you hire somebody in your backroom team who's good at that you just go, right,
I think it's a fair point.
I'm going to be the public face here. I'm going to make sure that the superstars are happy. I'm going to be the link with the past, and you're going to be my eyes and ears for the 95, 97 minutes that the match is actually on.
Yeah, I think that is a fair point. It's good management, as they say, and they delegate good people around you. Like I said, don't know enough of that Michael Carrick. Of course, we all know about kind of Mike Phelan and, you know, those type of people. I just don't know how good they are, having worked with them. But you're absolutely right.
It'd be remarkable if Carrick was already at the level of Guardiola or Tuchel at this early stage in his career, wouldn't it?
I think ideally you want, but the crux of it is you want to see those abilities in your manager, I think, as a player. You know, if you see any kind of deficiencies, you look at your manager and think, well, he's a great lad, nice fella, you know, nice 1v1, you know, good lad. But when push comes to shove, and those big moments come in games or whatever, and you see he's deficient that early, you see it. You know what I mean? He hasn't got those abilities. I think he'd as a player, he just kind of drops a little bit in your estimation. You know what I mean? I think when you have a manager who's kind of all-encompassing, you know, in terms of manager, in terms of managing players, but also tactically very astute in terms of setup of the team, great understanding. He's as good as that. He's all-rounded. Then I think as a player, you're thinking, oof, this man's absolutely top class, and there's a few of them around. But I think you're right, not all managers have that ability, and they get good people around them to kind of supplement them. But at the moment, that would be a little bit of a worry with Solskjaer at the moment. So yeah, I think he's got to be a little bit careful. I don't think he's heading for the door in the foreseeable. But
well, here's the thing, right? I didn't either. I certainly didn't like 3 weeks ago. I thought the wins were coming, the performances will get better. The international break was an opportunity to like bet everything in, but it's 3 defeats in 4. Now the West Ham game doesn't really matter, the defeats in the League Cup, except they haven't won a trophy, would have been no harm, and they picked a bad team for that. And it's like suddenly it does matter because they lose against Villa. And I actually thought the performance against Villa was not as bad as everybody made out. Watched the full game back. Villa got very lucky. It's one of those things. Villa aren't rubbish. It's, you know, it's not like losing to Villa. It's not like Villa losing to Villa in the last couple of years. It's actually, they're a really solid team and they have all their players back. So I can make the case. But if they lose against Villarreal or they don't win, then suddenly the pressure just ratchets up and it goes off track really quickly.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think the pressure does build. And kind of rightly so, for the reasons that I've said. So I'd be more interested in terms of I look at the set performances really. But performances come from in terms of how you set up and the players that you put on the pitch. So when I look at the team sheet, and I see the two lads, I see Fred and McTominay in centre midfield and Pogba pitched up on the left hand side of a three. For me, straight, I'm talking about in terms of set up of the team, setting the team up in balance, that type of thing, you know, players complement each other, etc. Straight, I'm thinking, oof, bloody hell, surely we're not still pitching Popper up on the left hand side of it. He can't play there. The same fundamentals there that in that team for me, which if you're gonna play with the two in there, you know, you haven't got that top class number six that we were talking about a little bit earlier, and you haven't gone invested in it, you haven't got brought that player to the football club, and that's another issue. Whether he could, we don't know. So you are where you are, you're gonna play with them two in there. Take Pogba out of the team. You know, you pick your Sancho, you pick Rashford, Martial, whoever it is who operates off the flanks, whoever you want. You know, don't play an Arthur, a central midfield player, left side of the three for me, because you're carrying him out of possession of the football, so straight away you're out of sync. So you got to see that for a start. Put Pogba in the team in his best position, one of those central areas, wherever it is a holding six or maybe an advanced eight, we can talk about that. But don't pitch him up on the flanks now, because he's no good to out possession your kingdom. So you got to see that. And if you see it, you've got to be bold enough to make that decision. Is he bold enough to take on those players and sit them out and bench him? I'm not too sure.
His
reaction to Ronaldo coming off the bench against Young Burns when he took him off, he took him off too late. He should have taken him off at half time for me. That kind of almost apologetic, one arm around the shoulder when he came off the bench. Oh, I'm really sorry. You know, I didn't really want to take you again. It's not a good look for me. You know, and I just feel as well, sometimes, yeah, let's get rid of the manager. Well, who's out there? As soon as you start having that conversation, Jay, you got to, well, who better's out there at the moment? Right, sack him now. Who are you going to put in there? And for me, it's like you got a guy screaming at you. I mean, unless Antonio Conte has taken a job in the past a couple of weeks, I don't know about. There's a manager there for me that can go in. He's got the kind of force, the personality, who's got the smarts in terms of setting up a team with the players that he has. And like that kind of tactical astuteness that we're talking about, for me to kind of really kind of transform that football club, people might say, oh, he's trying a grenade in here, this fella. I think maybe to a certain extent that's what it needs at Manchester United. Someone come in with absolutely total confidence in himself,
yeah,
and what he needs to do, understands the game, understands how to win titles and what's required in terms of the team.
Go on, Nathan.
Put on the pitch.
No, sorry, I was waiting for Kenny to finish to ask you about the fallout from the Villa game, and actually a common theme over the weekend, which was Bruno Fernandes sent out this massive apology for missing the penalty kick that cost Manchester United the game. We saw Rory McIlroy in floods of tears apologising to his teammates that he'd let down the entire continent at the Ryder Cup. Were apologies a thing when you were playing? If a player you were playing with did something stupid, got sent off in a... needlessly, would they come into the dressing room afterwards and apologise to everybody? Would you have expected it?
Vinnie Jones, eh?
I don't. I think there would be a small ignore. Maybe occasionally someone would come in. Or maybe it was a mistake. You know, bad back pass, cost you a goal. Maybe cost you the game. Maybe came into the dressing room somebody would hold their hands up, lads, that's on me. And that was it, really. It was done. I think that's fair enough, you know what I mean? I don't think it's necessarily required. If someone felt the need to offload that, it was down to me. But generally, the players kind of would accept it because we all know nature of the game. We all do it. As long as it doesn't happen too often, repeats itself, it can happen. So players suck it up, and I think they'd take that. But that was basically it, Nathan. It was basically within the confines of the dressing room. And I actually wouldn't expect it. I just certainly wouldn't expect that from somebody. We all feel it. I've made plenty of mistakes myself. And players know, you don't have to be told sometimes. You walk into the dressing room, they're your teammates, you know each other. I've made a mistake, it's cost us maybe points. I come into the dressing room. Sometimes I don't need to hold my hand up. I don't need somebody to point a finger at me. And players know, players understand that he's hurting. You know, I don't need to jump all over him. You know what I mean? Mm. So, yeah, to answer your question, no, there wasn't maybe somebody to hold their hand up occasionally, but that'd be it. People would kind of move on pretty quickly. Now, don't get me wrong, occasionally you'd walk into the dressing room after the game, someone's made a mistake, you'd get it. You know what I mean? He'd get it as well. You know, that would happen as well. You know, not necessarily, I'm not talking physically here, necessarily. Well, maybe occasionally, but... but that was it. But Nathan was always played out. I never remember anything getting kind of played out, you know, on the pitch or in public. It was always a case of, like, take it into the dressing room. You know, like, let's get into the dressing room.
I'm not sure if you're lurking on Instagram, Kenny. Like, you might have seen Bruno Fernandes' post. He said, "I will come back stronger for me because these are the standards I hold myself to, but most of all for my teammates and our fans." And David De Gea came back and said, "Always on my team, love heart." Cristiano just had a little fist bump. Harry Maguire, love heart. Juan Mata said, "Yes, we are, love heart." Bicep emoji. Jesse Lingard, two love hearts. Martial, love heart. Diogo Dalot, with you every day of the week, love heart. And Donny van de Beek, love heart and bicep. So, which of those would be your response if a teammate came in and said sorry?
Yeah, but that's obviously, I don't know, you're taking it to a different level.
Answer the question. Which emoji would you use?
I'm not in that environment, never have been. I'm not really around that, so I don't.
Do you use emojis?
Yeah, I send messages. So there would be an occasional emoji, but this is different, isn't it? So this is perception, what you're talking about, I'm guessing. And I'd feel as if this is now an obligation now, isn't it? So this is where we are.
Yeah, and who doesn't?
I need to be seen to
do it. I'm surprised Van de Beek had the balls and gumption to do it. He's not even part of the team. He's just like,
I forgive you, Bruno.
I'm here as well. Yeah.
It's like, what? I accept your apology.
Get out.
No, well, one of the few things I can't make a huge contribution to, I'm afraid. Like,
You did very well.
I've had a quick look back at all my messages with Kenny Cunningham. He likes a fist pump, likes an old fist pump, and an upside down smile.
All right. You're an upside down smile guy.
Oh, is this to you, Nathan? You're checking your previous text, Nathan. Is that it? I'm thinking,
yes,
is he going into my phone? That's a security issue. <he's there. laughs> Right.
It would have been a security issue. Yeah, very. I mean, phone hacking, we could. Yeah, Nathan would have been on sticky wicket there. But luckily, you sent those messages to him. Come here.
It's all right. Nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. But like I said, that's different, isn't it? This is thrown out there to the general public.
Yeah, exactly. That was private. That was private. He's
all
just
of that rubbish.
For breach of privacy.
Betrayed of confidence. Yeah.
Are you in any WhatsApp groups with the Crazy Gang? Are you in contact with any of those lads?
I wouldn't say regular contact. No. I have been a couple of get-togethers. I must admit, for some years, no, not so much. I wasn't big one for really turning up once I retired. Kind of, you know, around the place and stuff, so I wouldn't have seen it for a long time, but I pitched up a couple of reunion kind of Christmas get-togethers with the Don, so that was really good. Actually, it's good to see a lot of the lads. It was a good turnout. Yeah, they're a good bunch. You forget, really, don't you? They were a really good bunch
at the time. You're like, this is grand, I'll have this again, but then in retrospect, you remember there was something special there for a while.
Yeah, I saw every club, really. I wouldn't single out my time at Wimbledon as special, but I really enjoyed my time. Maybe didn't appreciate it as much, maybe at the time, maybe immediately afterwards, maybe looking back. Because I spent quite a bit of time. I forgot really a reasonable amount of time there. It's my most amount of 8 years, wasn't it, at Wimbledon. So, yeah, and it was a decent enough... Yeah, it was a decent enough time in terms of, well, not in terms of we did this and we won that and whatever, like, you know, but it was a nice, it was a good environment to be in. The dressing room was good, there was plenty going on. There was fireworks going off around. There was lots, you know, lots of stuff there.
We'll come back to that a little bit later on because we're just up against time. But you've raised a few things there that I wouldn't mind getting into a little bit later on. 0879 180 180 is WhatsApp. And he's shaking his head saying no. Sure, we'll see. We'll see. Send your questions in if you have one. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, Nathan.
With thanks to Gillette, we're celebrating the return to normality with a special prize of UEFA Champions League tickets to Chelsea against Malmo on the 20th of October with flights and accommodation included. You can enter on the Off the Ball Twitter page, so twitter.com/offtheball. We post an image of a bearded sports person every day this week. Who's this? Who does this beard belong to? Just respond to the post and tell us who the person is for your chance to win this amazing prize. Put your best face forward with Gillette, and the hashtag is best face forward. I do want to just call out one of the entries we've had. We never do this. Seamus McMullen from Dunloy says Gerry Adams.
Tommy Tiernan, eh?
Neither Tommy Tiernan nor Gerry Adams, but they both had salt and pepper. A bit of salt and pepper going on. Similar enough personalities. Very important people in Irish history. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take a quick break. We're back talking rugby with Irish rugby international Anna Capeless next.
If Didier Deschamps were to leave and Zinedine Zidane were available and he was not picked by the French Federation, the headquarters of the French Federation would have to look at what happened at the Bastille.
OTB AM, live, weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.